Ben, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
My pleasure. Mark, thanks for having me on the program.
When we talk about the idea of verbal self-defense, what exactly are we talking about? What does that encompass?
Well, we call it verbal defense and influence because the idea behind it all is twofold. One, conflict happens. So accepting that fact, as opposed to trying to deny it, means you're going to learn how to deal with it better. And at the heart of all of what we teach is the idea that you treat people with dignity to earn their respect. And when you keep that in mind, you can talk with anyone about anything, no matter what the conflict is at the get-go, because you can come back to the fact that, you know, we're both coming from the same place. We're human beings trying to get somewhere and trying to get somewhere together.
What makes the idea of verbal defense relevant these days?
I laugh only because it's probably more relevant today than ever before. The conflicts we see are in part because of the stress we have. People are so under the gun. They're afraid of missing the next text, of being late to something, of always feeling like they've got, you know, 10 hours to do 20 hours worth of work. So our stress levels are just higher, both internally and externally. So verbal defense and influence has been around for about 30 years, taught to law enforcement. We are also teaching it to healthcare professionals, educators. It's a tool to help kids 8 years old to fight back against bullying so they're not fighting. And it's across the board. This works for people who are 6 and people who are 66.
You know, you mentioned that it's been around for a little while, and you hear the terms verbal judo, verbal jujitsu, verbal aikido. They've been out there for some time now. Is what you're talking about here similar or different from those things?
You're spot on. It began with Doc Thompson. He was a cop after being a college professor, and he realized that the police weren't treating the people right. They weren't serving and protecting correctly. So he came up with something called verbal judo. He then started working with the Vistalar Group, which I work for now in Milwaukee, and the program grew, and it morphed from verbal judo to verbal defense and influence. There is a company that still works under the auspices of verbal judo. Doc Thompson unfortunately passed away a couple years ago, so the company that he had started is now still doing that. It's the same idea, that we can treat each other with dignity to earn respect using some real basic steps.
So the idea here is to deal with the situation before it escalates into something worse, say physical violence.
Yeah.
Kind of the old saying, the best fight is the one you're not in.
Exactly. It's getting to the gateway behaviors. Nobody ever starts doing heroin first. They do something else. So it's alcohol or marijuana, and they build up. Well, the same is true with conflict in many ways. Somebody doesn't come in at level 10. Something allows them to get there. So one of the VDI success stories we talk about has to do with a biker. We call it the biker story. He came to a children's hospital, big guy, 6'5", 6'7", 300 pounds. He was in a leather vest, sleeveless, tattoos all over the arms, and he had like a skull and crossbones belt. So he looked scary just coming in. And he walked into the hospital emergency room. Where do I park my effing car? And you know, all of a sudden, the kids in the waiting room,
oh my heavens,
who are
yeah.
already scared for what they're there for, are terrified.
I can imagine.
Our security consultant, who is working at the hospital, a guy named Joel Lashley, goes up to him and says, good morning, my name is Joel Lashley. I'm with security here at the hospital. I notice that you're upset and you're yelling. Can I ask you please to lower your voice and not to curse, because there are children here and they're already scared and you're frightening them. That's called a universal greeting. How he approached him: name, title, authority, position, and a question, a relevant question. That universal greeting is at the heart of all the verbal defense and influence that we do. Along with that, if I ask you, how do you behave in a library? You'd immediately say, well, we're quiet in a library. How do we behave in a hospital waiting room? It's not always so clear. Everyone's under stress there. Everyone could scream and yell. Nothing gets done well there in the chaos of everyone screaming and yelling. So there's what we call a social contract. And the social contract is, in the waiting room, we treat the nurses and the nurses treat the patients with dignity and respect. And that means you don't scream and you don't yell. So Joel explained to this guy, you can't scream and yell. It doesn't work here. Where do I park my effing car? He says, well, there's a valet. I'm not letting anybody drive my car, he says. So, all right. He said, well, the parking lot is, and he told him where to go. The guy came back. He had to walk about a mile round trip, so he's not real happy. And he's screaming at the nurses now. Now, the nurses say to him the same thing. You know, we can't have you yelling here. The kids are scared. So there's got to be consistency in the message. And actually, before he got to the nurses in the emergency room, he came into the front door where the little old ladies with the gray hair and the blue smock sit, and he's yelling at them. And, you know, they're four and a half feet tall. I mean, here's this giant screaming at them. And again, they say, "Excuse me, sir. At this hospital, we try not to yell. It scares the patients, and people have enough stress here. Could you lower your voice? I'll be glad to take you to the emergency room." So all along, he's hearing a consistent message. The social contract in this hospital is we do not yell. It's just like the library. He gets that. So by the end of his visit there, the doctors reported back to Joel, the security guy, this guy was a pussycat. When he left, he went back to the front door to the little old ladies and he apologized, saying, "I was out of line. I realized I shouldn't have been yelling here. I was under a lot of stress. Thank you for your help."
Is that because everybody stayed unflappable and kept it dignified and didn't let it get out of hand themselves?
They were dealing with his behavior. They weren't dealing with his attitude. And that is a practice. The other thing we have found is if you and I are in an emotionally charged situation and you're yelling at me, I can yell with you or I can talk quieter and you will come down to me. Emotions tend to match. The dominant emotion is what will pull you. So if I know not to go scream with you, you're going to stop screaming.
Sounds like a broken windows theory where you set a level of expectation. I'm not going to tolerate certain things. I'm going to fix things before they get worse.
And that's true. This is very true at home with my spouse and my child. It's true in the workplace. It's true with strangers that there is a certain level of expectation of how we will treat each other. Some people are better at it than others. The idea that conflict is always around us is something that is the given to all of this, that we can deal with it. It doesn't have to get out of control.
How important is listening to the whole idea of verbal self-defense? That's got to play a key role, I would think.
You're hitting my sweet spot. You know, after 21 years hosting on public radio, I realized I was practicing verbal defense and influence as a host. I just didn't know what it was called. You treat people with dignity and respect. That's at the heart of this. And we have something called the five maxims. And the five maxims are designed to get you to work with somebody and not tell them what to do. So if I need help in something, whether I'm the boss or the spouse or the parent, I'm going to listen to you from head to toe. That's the first and foremost thing to do. The second thing I'm going to do is talk to you by asking you to help me and not telling you what you have to do. If I ask you to help me and then give you context, the third maxim, you will tend to buy into what I'm looking for because you will understand why I'm doing it, which is really important to the human mind. And I've asked you. And people tend to want to help when they're asked, but sometimes there's pushback if you tell them what to do. The fourth maxim may be the most important. It's to give options. So, Mark, I need some help. Could you help me do fill in the blank? I'm not going to tell you how to do it. If you say, yeah, I'll be glad to do it. And if it's move the chairs, I'm not going to tell you that chair first and then the other chair second and the couch third. You may want to move the couch first. I don't care. You have the control. When I give you a choice on how to do things, I'm giving you your own voice, and that's really important. The fifth maxim, trying to get you to do something, is to give you a second chance. Recognize we all fail. So we want to give people the right to be wrong so they'll try, and then the right to try again so they can be right.
Talking with Ben Marins about the concept of verbal self-defense, he's with the Vistalar Group. And Ben, I can see these techniques would be useful in a lot of different professions, but there's also got to be some value in your personal life as well, I would think.
There is. One of the first lessons in verbal defense and influence is simply to respond and not react. And as a talk show host, as I said, I was practicing this with every phone call, with every guest. Responding, not reacting means thinking about what you're going to say, even if it's a millisecond, taking a deep breath and not just reacting. So if I come home and my wife or my daughter is upset about something and I take a minute to take a deep breath and assess what's going on and respond, we're going to do a lot better at the conflict management than if I just react and start screaming and yelling along with them. There's nobody more important to our individual lives than those who live with us. So we have two things there. One, an obligation to be at our best. And at the same time, the majority of the time, if we fail, we'll fail at home more often than anywhere else because those we love, those closest to us, are going to test us the most. It's just the way things work. But I practice this. My daughter just left to go to college. This summer, I asked her if she would clean her room after the springtime of telling her, I want your room cleaned. didn't get me anywhere. Once I even cleaned it for her. Big mistake. Now my wife and daughter were mad at me. So I'm thinking, you know, you're learning verbal defense and influence. You're working there. Take it home. So our daughter's name is Hope. I said, Hope, would you consider cleaning your room somewhere the next couple weeks before you pack for college? Because in my mindset, cleaning the room, packing for college, two separate jobs. If you do them together, it'll be pretty chaotic. And I didn't want the chaos. So I explained that to her. I said, if you would clean your room before we pack you up to go to college, I think the process will be better. I'll be glad to help you or stay out of the way. You can do it whenever you want, somewhere in the next 3 weeks. Would you be willing to do that? So that's the five maxims. And her answer was, sure, Dad. 2 weeks later, she cleaned a room.
At least it was 2 weeks later, yeah, and it got done.
Took me 18 years.
Ben, you were mentioning that this is a good way for children to protect themselves against bullying. Mm-hmm. So this is something you can start with a child even.
Some of our trainers, and I'm still trying to get my head around this, Mark, say that some kids who get bullied ask for it. They're victims in the walking, not even the making. So in a way, they're saying it's their fault. That's where I have trouble with it. I'm working on it. But the point they have is if somebody comes up to Ben and says, oh, Ben, look at your ears. You've got really funny ears. And I get mad. Well, I'm allowing them to bully me. But if my reaction is touch my ears, go, you know what? They are funny ears. They made me laugh. Hey, thanks for telling me. The bully's not going to stop bullying, but he's going to leave me alone next time. It didn't work. So you can teach this to a kid to say, listen, deal with the behavior, not the attitude. If they tease you about something, you have the right to respond any way you want. If you react, you're going to get bullied. But if you respond, use your head, take a deep breath, don't let them get to you. You will stop being bullied. And we have examples of that going on in schools all over the country where we teach this to teachers and we teach it to kids.
Can you give me some other examples of people who've successfully used these strategies to deal with conflict and avoid potential violence?
Well, a couple stories come to mind. One, I call it the drunk tank story. Our training director was a Milwaukee County sheriff, and he was a captain in the Milwaukee jail. And one night there was a guy who was really drunk screaming, I want my phone call. Gary went up to him, and Gary said, excuse me, sir, I'm Gary Klugowitz. I'm captain and in charge of the jail cell here. I understand you want your phone call, but I was wondering if you'd be willing to wait till tomorrow and sleep off your drunk, because right now you're out of control. I can't let you make a phone call. And the guy screamed and he yelled. And Gary is a master looking at somebody and saying, we've got some good options here and we've got some bad options here. Here are the good options. You calm down. I'll get you some water. Lay down. Go to sleep. Tomorrow morning, I will guarantee you'll get your phone call. Here's another option. I've got six of the biggest guys in the jail down the hall, and they've got the uniform on. You know the uniform. You can't bite them. You can't kick them. You can't scratch them. And the first thing they're going to do when they come in is secure you. If you don't calm down, you will get pepper sprayed. Now, I don't know if you've ever been pepper sprayed, Gary says, because I have in part of our training. We need to know what it's like. You're blind. You've got mucus coming out of your nose. You can't breathe. It's terrible. And, you know, they have to be pretty physically strong with you. Then they cuff you. Then eventually you get tied down. You're going to have to sleep like that. So at the end of all this, by the way, you still don't have your phone call. So that's not an option I want to use. I have to if you won't go with a good option. But if you go with a good option, we're good. And tomorrow I guarantee you'll get your phone call. And the guy said, you guarantee? Because I promise, first thing tomorrow morning, the guy laid down on his bunk and he went to sleep.
That's amazing.
So, and this is used with violent criminals in the prisons. It's used, as I said, all over the place. In this case, Gary wasn't threatening him. Gary was saying, this is what happens. And the choice is not mine, it's yours. So again, who's in control here? Even though this guy was drunk and out of his head, he was told, you're in control. You decide what happens the next 10 minutes.
It's your choice.
Sure is. Sure is. I was hosting a show one night. There was an editor on an East Coast college newspaper. And he decided, the staff, they were going to print the names of victims of sexual assault, sexual abuse, and rape. And I thought, that's a pretty interesting story. And I was on a statewide network in Wisconsin, lots of college papers. They'd maybe want to talk about this. So I asked him, why would you do this? He said, I had what we call victims come to me and say, I want my name in the paper. I didn't do anything wrong. I got raped. And I'm not going to hide here. I want my name printed. I want people to know that we can fight back. This is unacceptable. And the guy said, wow, I never thought of it that way. Okay. So he started putting the names in the paper. So I was getting calls on this. I had a woman call the show. And Sue, welcome to the program. She starts to tell her story, but she's throwing swear words in. And her story's really gripping. I mean, she'd been raped and she'd gone to the police and she was going through the whole process. And she thought what this guy was doing was wonderful. And in the middle of her story, I said, excuse me, Sue, I want to hear the rest of your story. I'm sure my audience wants to hear the rest of your story. But I can't allow you to stay on the network if you keep swearing. It's just, it's not acceptable. So if you will promise me you won't swear anymore, I'll let you continue. I'm not going to hang up on you, but you've got to do this. Social contract. So she apologized, spent 10 more minutes talking with us, didn't swear again. The verbal offense and influence, and this is before I knew what it was called, was showing her dignity, treating her with respect, letting her know the reasons why. Said, you want to stay on the air? You can't swear because it's not allowed. Giving her a second chance. And my audience got to hear her story, the benefit of what else she had to say, which was why I was working there, to get stories out to my audience. So even though I couldn't see her, it worked.
Ben, if you were going to recommend one of the strategies, if somebody only had time to learn one, what would be the first one they should learn and start practicing right away?
It's that universal greeting, because okay. We can all do it when we teach classes. We practice this from the get-go to say your name. And it's not just to say your name. You start by saying good morning or good afternoon or good evening to establish the time and somewhat of a connection. It's just it's a nicety that goes a long way. So I'd say to you, good morning. My name is Ben Marins. I am the media director for the Vistalar Group. I'm here to talk with you on the radio about verbal offense and influence. Are you ready to interview me? So I've gone through the steps, asked the relevant question. That could be done with my daughter to clean the room. It was done at the hotel when I checked in, when I visited Cincinnati to do this interview. And I told them who I was. I asked if my room was ready. I inquired about parking my car. And I asked if there was room service. So they were experiencing the universal greeting. I smiled. I looked them in the eye. And it was a human connection and not just somebody coming in wanting their room key.
Eye contact is important, isn't it? It's an empathy thing, right?
It is. And ironically, one of the lessons I teach is called the Four Faces of Empathic Listening. And I developed this as a radio host who didn't see the guests or the callers when I developed this. But essentially, it's important to look into the face of the other person. The four faces I talk about are seeing someone's child's face. So if you look at me, my eyes, my smile, it's the same as it was when I was six. The hair is gray and there's more skin and more chin. But we can all look at somebody else and imagine them as a six-year-old and try to picture them, I say, in the sandbox. Did they share? Did they step on somebody else's sandcastle? They throw sand? Were they kind? What kind of six-year-old was the person you're looking at? We can all practice this. The second face is the elder face. Nobody gets to be 50, 60, or 70, as goofy as we may think some old people are. No fools survive, because it's hard to live 50, 60, 70, 80 years. Try to see someone's wisdom that they've gathered. Look into their face and see what it was they figured out to get through the 5, 6, 7, or 8 decades. The third face, with me, it's pretty easy. I smile a lot, but I call it the face of joy. See someone's happiest moment. This is the most challenging face to see on the people who never smile. We all know somebody who just looks miserable. But I tell people, in their private moment, they all have what I call the chocolate moment. For me, it's chocolate. When they get that chocolate, they have a bite and they close their eyes and they taste it and they smile and they warm up. They just may not show the world that face, but I think it's important to see it. And then the fourth face I call the face of character. And we all unfortunately know this face because we've all been depressed. We've buried loved ones. We've lost jobs. We've lost money. Something that has knocked us to the floor. And yet somehow we get up. So that fourth face, the face of character, when you can look at somebody and see that, see what it took for them to climb the mountain in their life. Now you can really begin to know a little bit about who they are. You can't walk a mile in their shoes, but you can have a real good idea what it's like to have done it. So you see their child's face, their elder face, their face of joy, and their face of character. And again, I started this on the radio. It's a lot easier to do it when you can see them. I was teaching at Marquette University last semester, and when I said this to the students, a couple of the women sort of put their arms across their chest. I said, because I told them I was practicing this right now, I said, it's not X-ray vision, ladies. I don't see through your shirt. I try to see into your soul. And we can all do this. And then what you're doing is you're making sure the person you're talking to really feels heard. And when we feel heard, we feel validated. We feel as if we count. And that goes a long way to calming the waters if there is conflict, or preventing the conflict because somebody feels connected.
Is that what you mean when I think one of the Vistalar's principles is you have to go beyond just active listening, that that alone is not good enough. So is that what you're talking about here?
Beyond active listening is listening and then some. So getting a sense of where someone's coming from, their body language, their odor, their position. Are they sitting up straight? Are they bent over? Somebody walking? Are they limping? I mean, there's all sorts of signs and signals that we can take and let the other person know, yeah, I'm not just hearing your words. I'm hearing your whole self. And again, somebody's limping and you don't mention it. That's a pretty big hole. So, you know, you don't usually limp. What happened? Oh, I just fell down the stairs. Really? Are you okay? Because the other subject now is secondary. But if I'm not actively listening and watching and taking things in, I'm going to talk to you about whatever subject A was, and your mind isn't there.
Is there any role that bystanders can play in using verbal defense to cut off potential conflict and violence?
We have a book series, sort of like Chicken Soup for the Soul, called Confidence and Conflict. The first one is Confidence and Conflict for Everyday Life. The one we just came out with is called Confidence and Conflict for Campus Life. And this was put out by a security personnel at Marquette. And the idea here is that you can look at what's going on around you and ignore it, or you can look at what's going on around you and realize you're part of the community. So Jill Wiesenthal, who teaches this at Marquette University, lets the students as freshmen know you have a responsibility beyond yourself. You're part of a community. If you see somebody in trouble, you have an obligation to act. If someone's being held up, your obligation might not be to take the bullet, but it may be to make the phone call. If somebody is at a bar being taken advantage of because he or she is drunk, you can step in and offer to take them home. Or you can tell the bartender, or you can get a group of friends to go in and step in. But bystander mobilization, what we call this, is about being involved in the community around you and not just letting things pass you by saying, that doesn't affect me, because it does.
All these techniques sound wonderful, but what happens when words fail?
Well, are you talking about in my kitchen?
In any setting, for that matter.
When words alone fail is one of the lessons we teach. There are 10 steps in the conflict management program. When words alone fail, you have to decide what you're going to do. For nurses, for example, we have this for everybody. We talk about with nurses something called the 10-5-2 rule. At 10 feet, you can pretty much get away from any danger coming your way, or make the decision it's safe to go in the room and walk to 5 feet. At 5 feet, you're now engaged with someone. At 2 feet, you're at risk, but you're also in position to do good. So you need to be assessing, what do you do at 10, 5, and 2? And there are times when words do fail, and you have to decide which direction to go. If you're a police officer, you may have to get active physically. You may have to take someone down. You may have to cuff them, pepper spray them. If you're a nurse and the patient's violent and doesn't want the medicine or doesn't want their blood pressure taken, your option at that point may be to leave the room. So when words alone fail doesn't mean you put your fists up and you go at it. It means that you decide that, you know what, this technique today isn't working at this moment. I have to do something else. Get further engaged, maybe physically, or more likely for most of us, back off, find another way. It's funny, when our daughter was 2 and 3, she had a timeout. When my wife and I are having a disagreement, I take a timeout. It's the same process.
Wise.
We need to back off, take a couple deep breaths, respond, don't react. And when words alone fail is the perfect time to do that, because otherwise we can get in deeper than we want. It's tough to get out.
Now, you've got a conference coming up next month in Louisville. Tell us about that.
Well, I appreciate you mentioning that. Yes, we do. We are having our fourth annual Confidence and Conflict Conference. We call it Beyond Conflict 2014. We're having it not in Milwaukee like we usually have, but in Louisville, November 6th through the 8th. It is open to the public. It's designed to teach you verbal offense and influence. And there's a second education track where we can not only teach you VDI, but teach you how to teach it, because we are training people all over the country to become instructors so we can grow the company and grow the message. For people who don't want to come to the whole conference, if you're in the area and want to come to a session or two, you can do that for, I think it's $20 a session. So you don't have to spend the money for the whole conference. But if you want to come to the whole conference, there are packages to do that as well. It's at the Hyatt Regency in Louisville. BeyondConflict2014.com is the website. And in the website, there is an agenda for all the different classes that are being taught. And I have an audio book called People Are Dying to Be Heard. And we're turning that into a hardcover book with more stories and a little more lesson, and that book is being debuted at the conference too.
Are you getting a lot of positive response to what you're teaching, or are people picking up on this and saying that clicks? You're onto something here.
Yeah, we are, because in part it's so simple, and in part it's so necessary. So for nurses, and one thing I learned when I joined Vistalar half a year ago, healthcare professionals are 5 times more likely to be injured on the job and have to take time off than any other industry. And I just wouldn't have thought that patients would attack nurses. Patients don't necessarily do, but sometimes it's patients. Sometimes it's the families. The tension in hospitals, emergency rooms, and the like is pretty high. So the nurses hear about this training. They're like, oh my goodness, this is great. Because if I can find a way to better control the conflict, we have less injuries and less threat on the job. And we need our nurses. We can't afford to have them decide that it's too dangerous a profession. At Children's Hospital of Wisconsin, we've been doing this training for years. And a year ago, they had lost over 100 hours of comp time for injury. And in 2014, from January to October, right now they are at 0 lost hours due to conflict. So the conflict management is working. With police, it's working with nurses, it's working in schools, and it's effective just because we're teaching something that's necessary, but we kind of leave it out. It's sort of like basic personal finance in high school. We all probably should have learned how to balance a checkbook. Most of us didn't. It was after we graduated high school and started a checking account, we made our mistakes. But we can teach basic personal finance, we can teach conflict management, and it's just a matter of making the effort, and that's what we're doing.
Ben, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure, Mark. I'm so glad you had me here. Thank you.